It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up with more than 2 weeks left in 2021, Milwaukee has broken last year's record for homicides with nearly 200. Other U.S. cities have also surpassed similar records. We'll look at what's behind the increase in killings and what's happening with other types of crime. First, we rely on the media to provide accurate, reliable information, hopefully, about the COVID-19 pandemic. But so much has been unknown over the last 2 years, and everyone is still learning on the fly as new variants and treatments emerge. We're checking in now on how well mainstream media has covered the coronavirus throughout the pandemic, and we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. How well do you think the media has covered the pandemic? Were there times you thought coverage was overblown or underblown? Were there aspects you think haven't been covered enough? And of course, media is a big word. Were there particular outlets you thought did good or bad jobs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John Alsop is a freelance journalist and writer of the Columbia Journalism Review's daily newsletter, The Media Today. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, one complicated bit about a conversation about the media like this is there's so much that fits into the media. How much variety, how much diversity of coverage of the coronavirus have you seen across everything from maybe local TV news to major national platforms?
Yeah, well, obviously, as you said, the media is a big word and a big place and covers all sorts of outlets at every different level, you know, outlets at the local level, the national level, people who are broadly trying to get it right and tell you the facts, people who maybe that's not their top concern, who are trying to mislead or spread dis and misinformation. So, yeah, it's obviously hard to generalize across all of those outlets together. In the context of the pandemic, you, of course, also probably have a distinction between sort of general interest publications and more specialist media that cover science or health or medicine. And of course, the pandemic has been a huge story. I wrote in the early weeks of the pandemic that it's kind of an everything story. It covers every aspect of our lives and therefore every conceivable beat within a newsroom. And so I think to some extent, pretty much all journalism, at least in those sort of first months of COVID, was pandemic journalism. And even since then, journalism that's branched out into other big stories like the 2020 election or the racial justice protests following the murder of George Floyd, those have strong links to the pandemic as well and are informed by that backdrop. So yeah, a huge amount of diversity in the coverage, and it's hard to generalize. I do think, though, that particularly sort of top national level outlets in the US, I think it's often possible to kind of discern trends in the way that they cover big stories. I think there are sort of rhythms that are kind of inherent to the way the media works and the way the news is structured. And I think increasingly those sort of filter down to the local level too, not least because you have a general decline in sort of local newspapers across the US. Those titles are more reliant than ever on wire copy coming from the Associated Press or other national services. So yeah, I think it's hard to generalize, but it's also not impossible, I think, to discern some kind of broader trends that we've seen, you know, throughout the pandemic in the way the media has covered it.
Yeah, what kind of trends leap out to you?
I think that the pandemic has been an enormously challenging story for the press to cover because there's been so much uncertainty really at every point. And I think that coverage across the board has often been kind of reactive rather than proactive, sort of covering what we know based on kind of what we could see at any given moment, even if we kind of know that what we can see is not the full picture, right? So in the early part of the pandemic, I think there was a temptation across large swathes of the media to cover, you know, case counts and death counts as kind of definitive, as like, you know, this is reality, we're being told these are the stats. This is, you know, the spread of the pandemic today. Here are today's numbers. In fact, we knew at the time, we should have known, that these numbers were very incomplete. The case count, of course, was a function of testing, and we know that not enough of that was being done. The death count was always an undercount based on what the number was at any given moment. We didn't sort of have a great deal of visibility, I think, or not perfect visibility. And yeah, I think that it's tempting for journalists to look at what they can see sometimes, particularly in really uncertain sort of new territory, like we found in the pandemic, and sort of conclude, you know, this is the story, here's what's actually happening. I think that, you know, there were many journalists who covered the early part of the pandemic, the sort of January, February 2020 time when it was in China and then spreading to other countries, you know, and I think they did a great job of doing it. But I think if you look at lots of major outlets, particularly in political media, they probably didn't cover this emerging pandemic with the degree of urgency or centrality that it, you know, in hindsight, very clearly merited, given that it's upended all of our lives on a global scale. I think those are probably some of the trends. And of course, there are others too.
I wanted to ask you about that urgency of coverage and intensity. That's something I've been thinking about a lot since early last year and really before. We've been here before where there's a virus in another country, Ebola in West Africa, H1N1, and we're looking from the United States and trying to figure out, how bad is it going to be here? How much coverage do we do? Where do we hit the point where we're causing a panic unnecessarily? Where are we emphasizing something that really is a serious story? Whether we're talking about early days of COVID or the first days of the Omicron variant, it's an open question. How do you think journalists should approach that unknown, how bad is this going to be question?
Yeah, I think it's easy to look back in hindsight and kind of conclude that, you know, if you weren't sort of really sounding a five alarm fire about this from like the last week of January or the first week of February, you weren't doing your job properly in light of everything that came afterwards. And I think there's a case to be made for that argument, to be sure. But I also think that it is a bit more complicated than that. You know, we have had, you know, in the recent past, other diseases that sort of looked like they might become something really serious for the entire world that then didn't. And there is, I think, always a concern that coverage could possibly be overly alarmist about those emerging illnesses. You know, there were very good science and health reporters at the time who had a very clear sense that COVID was going to be a pandemic from pretty early on, but also very respectable journalists and experts, including within the US government, who said that they didn't think that it would be. So I think there was conflicting information coming from experts and official sources at that time, which makes it hard to kind of definitively predict the future. And of course, just at the most basic level, predicting the future is kind of hard and is not what journalism is most fundamentally about. So, I don't think it's a completely cut and dried thing to say that, you know, this was a clear failure in every respect. And of course, as I mentioned before, there were, you know, outlets and reporters who were taking this seriously very early on, and they deserve credit for doing so. I do think, though, that particularly, you know, going into sort of late February and early March, when it was very clear that this had not been contained on a global scale, when, you know, you saw real devastation in Iran and in Italy and in other countries far from China, I do think there was probably an element of exceptionalism and complacency in some US media and in other Western countries too, to think that that's still an over there problem. By that point, it was very clearly something that was coming. It was just a question of when. And yet the kind of normal rhythms of the media sort of in some ways continued. You know, I think in that early part of March, the Democratic primaries were probably a bigger story than the pandemic. You can make the case in US political media and just sort of general interest media more broadly. That was clearly an underreaction, and we should have known that by that point. And I include myself, by the way, in terms of the stuff I was writing about in that underreaction. I think it's interesting just quickly what you mentioned with the Omicron variant, because I think in some ways what we saw was kind of the opposite when that sort of became, you know, a variant of concern, and the World Health Organization gave it the name Omicron. Major news organizations really jumped on that story very quickly, and they faced kind of the opposite criticism, right, from lots of media critics and some scientists. You know, there was so much that we didn't know about it, in terms of, you know, vaccine efficacy against it, in terms of transmissibility, in terms of severity. And I think there was a sense among some of those critics that maybe it didn't deserve to be hyped up as like the top big story of the day until we knew more. But then, as I wrote, you know, in the days after Omicron emerged, it wouldn't be hard to imagine what, you know, media critics might say a few weeks down the line if it did turn out to be a hugely significant variant, I think there's some evidence it is turning out to be that. The emergence of it didn't get covered to a particularly significant extent or with a particular degree of prominence. So I think in short, these questions are really, really hard, and there are competing impulses you have to weigh up. And this environment of extreme uncertainty that doesn't ever seem to leave us alone in this pandemic only makes those calculations harder. But
we're talking to Columbia Journalism Review writer John Alsup about media coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic. You can join in with your thoughts, questions at 800-642-1234. Outlets you think got it right. Outlets you wish had done things differently. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about mainstream media coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic with John Alsup. He's a writer for the Columbia Journalism Review. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the topic. Let's go to your calls now. Marita starts us off in McHenry, Illinois. Marita, hi.
Hi. I'm a nurse that has been in practice for probably 50 years, and part of my big part of that nursing was to explain to patients what that disease that they were experiencing and how it affected their body, because I found that most people did not understand what happens inside their skin. And the New York Times did a great job real early on showing what the COVID virus was, but no one has really picked up on any colored cartoon, and I mean cartoon in a good sense, mm-hmm. of how this virus infects the body. They do not understand that mRNA is a part of their body. And when I tell people this, they are totally floored. And that's why I think they look at mRNA and say, I'm not going to put that in my body. And they don't realize that it's already there. They do not understand how the virus gets into the cell. Why aren't the cartoonists doing something like that in a newspaper?
Marita, interesting. Thanks for bringing that up, John. Marita wants more, I think, kind of nuts and bolts visualizations of how this disease functions in our body.
Yeah, that's a super interesting point, certainly. I have to say I don't feel like I've seen any cartoons that sort of demonstrate the mechanics of how this virus actually kind of works within your body or indeed, how the vaccines work against it. That's not to say there haven't been any. I just feel like I personally haven't seen that. I do know that while there are still a lot of great cartoonists out there, editorial cartooning is sort of something that's been in decline, obviously, along with other parts of the media too. So maybe that has something to do with it. I do think we have seen throughout the pandemic that major sort of national news organizations with big resources in particular have, done a good job of trying to visualize what they can about the virus. Obviously, it is tough because, again, there's so much that we don't know about it, even at this point in terms of precise mechanisms of transmission. I remember the Washington Post very early on did a very memorable, not a cartoon, but a sort of animated graphic sort of showing how transmission works. That kind of, I think, did very well at the time and was quite helpful, explaining that dynamic when it was very new to a lot of people, and has sort of stuck with me since. I think in general, even just beyond those kind of viral mechanisms in the body, it's been something of a hard story to illustrate. Early on, it was sort of difficult, if not impossible, for photojournalists to get inside hospitals and sort of show what the virus was doing to other people's bodies in a way that was kind of really visceral. There was some great journalism that did that, but it was complicated because of safety and access and privacy issues in hospitals. So, yeah, I think that not just what you're talking about, but that broader question of visualization is a super interesting one in the pandemic. There's been some really innovative work there by lots of news organizations, but it has been something that's been a challenge throughout, I think, and there could be more of it.
Marita, thanks for that call. We'll go to Gary next in Iron River. Gary, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Let me make two quick points. One, we've got a whole bunch of experts that are well-qualified, apparently, teaching at well-known schools or practicing at the top medical clinics with differing views on containment and treatment and vaccines. Well, maybe not so much different on vaccines, but on treatment. And news agencies tend to pick the ones that they like that may support their views. There's little effort put at having these groups or these individuals that are well qualified with very diverse views and trying to help people understand which ones might be right, and they're very divergent. The second quick comment is, additionally, most of the discussion has been around the direct medical and health impacts of COVID and what we do about COVID without properly integrating that issue with the effects on the economy and the effects on the economy as it can affect people and psychology and all the rest of that. We're hearing a little bit of that now, but it's after the fact rather than thinking that should have been taken into effect as we figured out how to deal with it.
Gary, thanks a lot. A couple of interesting points there, John. His first point, you know, if you've got different medical professionals, we've seen this all along, and you've got most of them saying one thing, another saying another. Think of, you know, a couple health professionals promoting hydroxychloroquine. To go back an example last year, that didn't last too long in the scope of things. How can people in the media, we're mostly not health professionals, how can we sort out when that outlier, you know, should be part of the public conversation?
Yeah, the media's relationship with experts, and I guess like the broader concept of like what constitutes expertise in the middle of this kind of new uncertain event, has been super interesting to me throughout the pandemic. And yeah, I think journalists are very well accustomed to when they have to do a story on something they maybe don't fully understand themselves, or that they want to communicate in a kind of communicate a complicated concept as simply as they can to their audience. They're very accustomed to picking up the phone, calling an expert in the field, and that expert will give them a kind of summary of the sort of state of knowledge in that field, right? It's something journalists do all the time. How do you do that when you're in the middle of a novel pandemic that's changing all the time, where there's no kind of consensus, even among equally well-credentialed experts, on sort of so many different elements of not just the science, but also the social science behind it too? You know, I think personally that actually experts disagreeing with each other and having lively debates and sort of working in good faith to kind of collectively get to a place where they have expanded knowledge of the pandemic is how science works. Science is messy. It's a messy process that moves forward slowly and involves disagreement and competing hypotheses. The problem, I guess, is, or not the problem per se, because I don't think it is a scientific problem, but the unusual aspect of it for the media and the public is this is all played out in real time in a very kind of bright public spotlight that is very atypical. And I think people who aren't used to seeing that kind of level of scientific disagreement can look at it and get scared, or maybe think that experts don't know what they're talking about when actually they're just engaging in the normal process of science. And I think that journalists could have been better throughout the pandemic at not presenting one individual expert as a kind of extant authority on, you know, the entirety of COVID, but sort of trying to tease out those disagreements that were made in good faith a bit better. Just very quickly on the second point, I actually kind of think that there's been kind of a false dichotomy drawn between COVID and the economy, particularly early on, you know, sort of presentation of a debate between should we have public health, should we have the economy in good health. Of course, those things, I think, are completely complementary objectives. You can't really run a successful economy without people being healthy. And so, yeah, I think we've maybe got better at sort of integrating that debate over time and sort of seeing how these things are all interconnected, as that has proven to be the case in all of our lives. But yeah, so I think that maybe a problem with coverage there early on was a kind of false one or the other kind of drawn between those topics.
Thanks for the call, Gary. Talking to John Alsup from the Columbia Journalism Review about media coverage of COVID. Back to your calls now with Mike in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. One of the things I don't see enough about is this new technology, the mRNA, and really, maybe I'm missing it, but I see it as possibly leading to cures for Lyme disease, rabies, Ebola that was mentioned earlier. You could almost see in 10 years going to the doctor and having a la carte. What do you want to be vaccinated against? And there might be 100 different vaccines out there in 10 years or 20 years that you could just choose from. I think that this new mRNA technology hasn't been really covered enough. At least I haven't seen it covered.
Mike, thanks for the call. That's probably one for the science and health reporters, John, but it's an interesting point. I think we're so focused on COVID-19 and what this technology means for the, understandably, for this disease that we're living through now, we might not be looking at some of the wider possible implications, the wider maybe benefits of this kind of technology. Thoughts on that in just our last minute or so?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting point, and clearly it's a hugely promising technology that might end up being one of the really good things to come out of this pandemic. I'm not a scientist, and I would say I've seen some pretty good, more expansive coverage of the potential of mRNA technology. But I think it has sort of been more sort of in specialist publications or on the kind of health and science pages rather than a top story. As you, I think, noted, this is obviously a sort of future-facing thing, and we're trying to get out of this pandemic now. And so I think it's understandable that the focus has been on this technology's use in this pandemic. But it's possible that if there'd been a sort of wider, more prominent integration of that longer term potential in sort of the context of the use of that technology against COVID, maybe it would have changed the way some people saw the technology, possibly. I don't know. I don't have a strong position on that necessarily. But yes, it is an interesting longer term storyline to watch for sure.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. And John, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's John Alsop, a freelance journalist, writer of the Columbia Journalism Review's daily newsletter called The Media Today. He joined us for a look at media coverage of COVID-19. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that topic. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know what you think. It's been another record-breaking year for Milwaukee, but not in a good way. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, there have been 193 homicides in the city in 2021. The previous record was 190 set last year, and there's still 2.5 weeks left to go. 90% of those deaths involved guns. It's a similar story in other cities around the country. ABC News recently reported that a dozen cities, including St. Paul, Minnesota, have also reached all-time highs for homicides, and like Milwaukee, some of the broke records that were just set last year. Experts say there's no one clear answer for the jump in homicides, but they've got some suspicions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this uptick in homicides over the last couple of years? Are you worried about violent crime in your own community? What do you think would need to happen to bring those numbers down? Do you work in a field where you see these firsthand as a police officer or in a hospital? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Janice Awama is an assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University. Her research interests include bias and hate crimes, communities and crime, gun legislation and violence, and policing. Janice, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, after a violent 2020, I think there was a lot of hope that it would be a one-year blip. Unfortunately, 2021 doesn't seem to be bearing that out. Were you surprised to see those numbers stay high this year?
I was surprised that the numbers remain that high, particularly with the expectations that as we reopen during the pandemic, that would be a lot more opportunities for violence interrupting programs like going back to school, a little bit more of a normal routine. So it is unexpected.
Where are we seeing this? We see the headlines, of course, about big cities. I've seen some smaller stories that say, smaller sized cities, other communities are seeing upticks in homicide. What do we know about that so far?
So far, we won't know anything until the following year, but it looks like based on some of the preliminary data we have for 2021, that some of the largest cities are experiencing some spikes, significant spikes, nearly twice as many homicides, twice as many aggravated assault cases. Some of the smaller cities are also seeing some of that, not quite to the extent of some of the larger metropolitan areas, but it looks like across the area in rural, suburban, and urban areas that there is a spike. The extent of that definitely varies across different areas.
Let's get into the why now. And I think there are a lot of easy answers that maybe any one of them isn't always borne out. But what do you look toward, Janice, to explain these increases?
Sure. You can view the increases. It's very difficult to say, and we probably won't know for a couple of years, but there's two different thoughts that have come up. One is associated to the pandemic following COVID-19, of course, and the second is changes in policing. The first, obviously, the pandemic has led to an increase in unemployment. A lot of individuals at home trying to take care of sick relatives, and of course, some of those stay-at-home restrictions. The lifestyles that we now carry have dramatically changed since prior to COVID, prior to March of 2020, that possibly could have an impact on some of human behaviors. Also, some of the institutions that we generally depend on to help interrupt some of the violence that takes place, for example, education. We know that for a fact that with the closing of so many different schools across the United States, in light of the spikes in COVID-19, have led to a lot of kids at home, a lot of kids on the streets that don't have homes to go to, the lack of after-school programs that we also see as an opportunity to divert some of that violence, to provide assistance to some of those at-risk students that could potentially be violent prone or have also been closed as a result of COVID-19. Both government and non-government agencies that are generally there to divert some of that violence were no longer available during the pandemic. On the second hand, we also had changes in policing, specifically changes in policing as a result of social distancing, trying to reduce the number of citizens to police contacts because of the fear of COVID-19. The number of protests we felt since last summer associated to or concerned with the lack of trust and a lack of legitimacy with policing have also affected policing. A number of protests, for the most part, have removed some of those police officers from the smaller communities into those areas that we knew there were going to be police protests. Of course, the lack of trust and legitimacy by citizens meant that citizens were now going to take justice into their own hands and or also not report crimes because they no longer trust the police. They don't view them as a legitimate source to provide them with assistance. And so the likelihood is these two particular areas that do overlap have influenced some of the crime that we are seeing from last year and the crime that we are seeing even this year up until December of 2021. And the likelihood is that the spike in violent crime will be found in the national FBI data once it comes out by the end of the following year.
Talking to Janice Owama, assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law and Criminology at American University, looking at increases, substantial increases over the last couple of years in the number of homicides, especially gun homicides, especially in big cities around the country. Milwaukee sadly just set a new record, breaking last year's record. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the topic, your questions for our guest, solutions you might like to see. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to tackle that last point you just brought up, Janice, about lack of trust between communities and police, maybe leading to people not reporting that smaller crime, and then that festers and leads perhaps to a homicide. How does a community start to rebuild that trust? How does a law enforcement agency start to rebuild that trust?
Absolutely. I think communities can start engaging in some discussions with police agencies, whether through an organization, whether through separate opportunities or events that happen to take place in their own community, and start really thinking about not going back to what is already in the books for policing, but thinking about innovative ways of trying to change policing. Obviously, one of the concerns we've had is the lack of reports, the underreporting of certain crimes. For example, there was also a spike in hate crimes. The underreporting of hate crimes meant that police officers who depend on citizens to engage in these types of issues and try to resolve these types of issues are no longer aware of any type of incident taking place. Police agencies, on the other hand, can think of their policing practices. Policing practices that generally carry a view of being discriminatory in nature, for example, stop and frisk practices, require almost a review to try to better understand whether or not they are actually leading to discrimination, they are actually leading to racial profiling in their own communities. Some of these conversations, while they are taking place in some cities, are not taking place in various different locations. They're not taking place and allowing citizens an opportunity to voice their concerns. There is also missing data and information on how policing has changed, whether it can change, and how we might go about doing that. And I will say now is a good opportunity, particularly as you see new leadership and so many police agencies, a new police chief coming up in so many different cities, to start engaging in those types of conversations and creating a new platform for citizens to engage with those police agencies.
I want to throw a couple other suggestions I've seen out there that people have linked to the rise in homicides. Police agencies are facing the same problem that many other employers are. They can't get enough people onto the job. Some of that might be driven by protests. Some of it might be driven by people retiring earlier because of COVID or wanting less risky types of work. Do you see this as a personnel problem in part?
Absolutely. Almost every major agency we've spoken to is extremely understaffed. They're understaffed and they're overworked. There's been a lot of police officers who've since retired, a lot of police officers who've had to take medical leave, either because of their own families, their loved ones having to take care of them during the pandemic, and they're tired. And that is something that police leadership really needs to account for. They need to think of better strategies to help their police employees in order to address some of their concerns they have, particularly as so many police officers had to take leave because of their kids, because of their significant others. And of course, there's also concern with how do we start recruiting the right police? How do we start making sure that police officers that we're trying to bring into the force are doing the right thing? And how do we recruit from a more wider, diverse group of police officers? That is something that you have to do intentionally rather than waiting and sitting back and depending on sort of previous practices that existed in policing.
Another explanation people have offered is a boom in gun sales last year, and 538.com did an analysis showing the time to crime, when a gun is bought to when it shows up in a crime, jumping a lot last year. Is the availability, apparently wider availability of guns, part of the story here?
Absolutely. I think both the increase in gun sales and the increase in reported guns found by police agencies while seizing guns at crime scenes has been a significant issue and has led to, in large part, a lot of the violent crime we are seeing, particularly when those cases, when we talk about homicides, the spike in homicides, somewhere between 80 and 90% of those homicides are associated to gun violence. A lot of those aggravated crimes or aggravated assaults are also associated to gun violence. And that is something we need to sort of take into consideration, particularly as so many different states are starting to consider gun control legislation. How do we improve the existing legislation in gun sales that allows individuals to purchase a firearm, particularly as so many incidents have taken place across the United States?
We're talking about the increasing homicide rates in many U.S. cities. Janice Awama is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this increase in homicides last year and this year in particular? After years of declines, lower levels compared to, say, the 90s, how worried are you about your own safety in your community? And what do you want to see change, if anything? More police, different kinds of policing, community efforts, education, gun regulations. What do you want? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about a rise in homicide rates in cities across the country. A recent ABC News story highlighted 12 major U.S. cities that have broken annual homicide records. At 13th, Milwaukee, sitting at 193, six more than last year's record high. Janice Awama stays with us, assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University. You can join us at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your ideas on what might be causing this increase in violence, possible solutions to it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to Amy in Green Bay. Amy, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I had two comments about why we might not, or why we're having lesser police and more increase in crime. Number one, this whole idea of defund the police has been demoralizing to police, and many of them have just said, we're done and out of here. And as far as the cities seeing big increases, I know in Chicago, we're just a state line over, and they required vaccinations, and many of them said no, and they left and took jobs in suburbs or towns where they weren't forced to be vaccinated. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Amy, thanks for the call. Janice, first of all, the defund the police slogan that came out of the protests you mentioned last year, is that part of the story here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with following the police protests associated to sort of the push towards defunding the police has led the morale behind police agencies pretty low. I think a lot of police agencies have unfortunately engaged in what we consider to be depolicing, where they've taken a step back from some of those responsibilities, whether consciously or unconsciously. I think to a certain extent, some of the surrounding issues associated to changes in policing, the removal of certain police chiefs, the departure of certain police chiefs that so many police officers follow, has left some police officers feeling like they're not certain how things are going to move forward. And of course, changes to some of the protocol associated to mandating vaccines has been a significant issue, particularly as the short turnaround has expected so many officers to sort of be vaccinated within a short time period. I do think that this is sort of the reason why police agencies not only need to focus on trying to engage with their citizens and their residents, they also need to have a conversation with their own officers and trying to develop what is a path for both increasing trust and legitimacy in their own communities, but also increasing trust within the agency, making sure that officers are aware of the changes before those changes take place. Having conversations with how it affects them and their families is something that we don't see happening, because as soon as one leader leaves, another leader comes in with an agenda with very little conversations, very little understanding about what that change is going to look like.
Thanks a lot for that call, Amy, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Micah in Elgin, Illinois. Micah, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. One thing that I wanted to talk about is that this is not surprising at all, honestly. I'm a communications major, and a lot of what I have studied this past semester has been social unrest and all of the structures that go into crime and stuff like that. And honestly, this is kind of the tipping point. This is something that is built up for a long, long time, you know, with the pandemic, with people losing their jobs, with just a whole lot with all the police issues. People are tired. People are scared. People are angry. And unless these systemic issues are resolved, then we're not going to see a lot of peace.
Micah, thanks a lot for that call. Janice, Micah sees systemic issues here that aren't going to be solved quickly.
Yeah, absolutely, Micah. You're right about that. I think there is a need for change, but that change should not be going back to what we used to do or what has been done in the past. I think when we talk about change, and I walk into so many of these community meetings that happen to engage with police agencies, people are not looking to go back to previous practices or looking to go back to things that they've done in the past, but they're looking for innovative ways. They're looking for a new path, a new change, rather than simply trying to go back. I mean, a lot of the issues we see with policing, we saw in the 1960s and 70s. This isn't old news. This isn't new news. Rather, this is old news. This is something we've seen before. When we talk about, you know, discriminatory policing, when we talk about racial profiling, these are issues that have taken place in the United States for a very long time. But we've oftentimes done very little and hope that with a certain change or a certain policy in place, we might be able to get rid of it. But the truth of the matter is these are conversations that need to happen every day. They need to happen every month, and they need to continue happening. As soon as an issue goes away, we shouldn't stop having these conversations. What we need to do is really think outside of the box, and police agencies need to be part of that conversations. Policymakers need to be part of that conversations as much as community leaders.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about an increase in homicides, especially in U.S. cities, with Janice Owama from American University. Back to your calls now. Matt is with us in Bemidji, Minnesota. Matt, hi. Are you there, Matt?
Hello.
Yep, go for it, Matt.
Yes. Hi. So the question I have is about what the data is generally showing when it comes to the spatial and neighborhood areas where the increase in homicide is occurring. And then I'm also curious about the actual context of these homicides. And the reason I'm asking these questions is based on what I've seen in the data over past years in my line of work, a lot of homicides, it's usually about half, tend to be lovers' quarrels, and then a good number of them as well are between friends and people. You know, they get angry with each other. And so I'm just wondering if, like, contextually, just people are under more stress, et cetera, that's leading to this.
Interesting, Matt. Thanks for the call. A couple of big questions there, Janice. First of all, how localized this violence is. I've talked to researchers in the past who say a lot of times you could really focus in on a few city blocks even to find a lot of the violent crime. Do we know yet, again, given that we still don't have all the data for this year, of course, do we know how localized this violence is?
No, absolutely. So far from what we know from some of the major cities that are already providing that data on their own websites, we've found that, as you've noted before, violent crimes is very focused on just certain city blocks. It's affecting a very small number of communities and a very small number of people, even with gun violence more broadly, not only murders, but talking about gun violence in general. People that are being affected by that every day of their lives are living in those particular areas, and it's really not evenly distributed across the city. We found from a recent survey very much an illustration of that. There's so many people that discuss defunding the police. People in those particular areas that really are experiencing and traumatized by gun violence are not asking. They want police to be involved in it. They want police to help deal with their everyday situation, which is gun violence. It is a real problem. It is a real problem for a small number of people, small number of communities, and it is definitely something that needs to be addressed.
And Matt also brought up the issue of domestic violence, homicide. Do we know how big a part of the story of record homicides that is?
Unfortunately, with domestic violence, we know of those cases that are being reported. Domestic violence in general is an extremely underreported crime. Even more so during the pandemic, we found that of those surveys that have been done of a number of households, that in domestic violence incidents, very few were reported. We saw a slight drop, even though we know for a fact that that is not the case, because so many people just did not want to make those calls during the pandemic due to concerns, again, of social distancing. But with so many people at home, the assumption is, due to the level of unrest, that there was an increase in domestic violence. And unfortunately, those were the cases, both for the victims themselves and police agencies, that became so difficult to respond to, particularly during the height of the pandemic.
Thanks for that call. Just in our last minute and a half, Janice, so many of the things you're talking about don't sound like they have quick fixes. That said, if a mayor of a big city facing this problem called you up and said, is there something we can do to try to turn things around for 2022, what suggestions would you have for them?
Absolutely. There are not any quick fixes. By no means do I want to sell that point, but there are ways to begin having these conversations. There are so many cities that are starting to engage in some innovative practices. For example, when we talk about some of those everyday incidents like traffic stops and the concerns with discriminatory policing, racial profiling in traffic stops, there have been a lot of cities that, for example, have gotten rid of making the primary reason for stopping an equipment violation in order to increase the trust and legitimacy with their citizens, in order to reduce the number of altercations that could potentially take place. There's a lot of communities that have also started developing more opportunities for engaging in conversations, trying to get citizens to report any citizen complaints, not in person, but via an app. I think some of these innovative practices that are already taking place in some of the major cities like New York City, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., are something that cities have to start taking a look at and seeing, you know, are these effective? If they were able to implement them in their own city, would it help some of those issues that are currently in place? Would it help address some of the concerns that their citizens have? I think we need to start looking at what other places are doing to try to incorporate that rather than starting from scratch. I also think people need to start thinking and getting into conversations, not necessarily in person, but virtually, because there is an opportunity, there is a platform, and there are a lot of people that want to be supported. There are a lot of people that want their concerns addressed. And so I think with so many new police leaders coming into place, this is a great opportunity to change the way things are.
So we'll leave it. Thanks to our guest, Janice Owama, assistant professor at American University's Department of Justice, Law and Criminology, joining us for a look at rising homicide rates.